Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Okay, I'm very excited to be talking to Dr. Arthur Laffer, who is an economist. In fact, he kind of triggered a worldwide tax cutting movement in the 1980s. So for those of us who like low taxes, I guess maybe we have Dr. Laffer to thank. Do we in fact have you to thank, Dr. Laffer?
I don't know if you do or not, but I loved it. It was wonderful. And I enjoyed working and cutting taxes and creating prosperity the world over. It was really fun.
Okay, so as I'm sure, or maybe you've heard from time to time, there are people who say this just doesn't make sense. They talk about your Laffer curve and then they start laughing. They say, how is it that if you take in less money by cutting taxes, you're supposed to make more money? So before we dive into some of the deeper questions, is there logic in what you're talking about?
Well, yeah, sure there is. They're conflating tax rates with tax revenues. And very seriously, at zero tax rates, you're not going to collect any money. If there are no taxes collected on any income, there won't be any revenue collected. Likewise, at 100% tax rates or even higher, if every time you went to the office, instead of getting a check, you got a bill, sooner or later, everyone would quit working and there would be no tax revenues either. So there are these two points where you have zero tax revenues. And then as you raise tax rates from zero tax rate, you're going to start collecting more and more revenues. And as you lower them from 100%, you're going to collect more and more revenues. And there's some sort of point somewhere in the middle there where you get the maximum amount of revenues. And that's sort of the Laffer curve. It relates tax rates to total revenues, which really is what you need to do. And there's no logic, to be honest with you, relating tax rates directly to revenues. If you increase tax rates 10%, I guarantee you, you will not get 10% more revenue.
Okay, so when you, I just want to clarify, because when you said look in the middle and you'll see a point where I guess they maximize revenues, you're not referring to actually a 50% tax, are you?
No, it's not. It may not. I mean, it doesn't have to be anything in there. It can be very high at 80%. It can be very low at 20%. It might be 50%. But that's only under specific circumstances, by the way. It depends very much on the time horizon you're looking at. The shorter the time horizon, the higher that rate will be. The longer the time horizon, the lower that rate will be. And, you know, it depends on a lot of other things. But what it is, it's a pedagogic device that explains to politicians that there are two effects tax rates have on revenue. One is the amount of tax you collect per dollar of tax base. That's the tax rate there. But then there's also the economic effect, which is if you raise tax rates, you'll reduce the tax base. And these two effects always work in the opposite direction. I mean, they always do. To use an analogy, a business can overprice its product and lose money. It can underprice its product and lose money, but there's a certain price in there where it makes profits, and there probably is a price that they maximize profits.
So let's clarify. You're not, in the Laffer curve, you're not proposing a specific tax rate. You are simply defining the fact that at 0% tax, the government makes zero, and then 100% tax, the government will probably make zero because no one will want to work. And there is just simply a point that may change depending on a variety of factors at which the government could maximize its revenue, presuming that's the actual goal.
Yeah, but that shouldn't be its actual goal. But yes, that's it. And the point is also is that when you change tax rates, like let's say we're going to raise taxes in the U.S., if you raise tax rates, you're not going to collect that much more in revenue. You might even lose revenue, depending on where the tax rate is now. What it does is give you a different way of looking at tax rates and the correct way to look at them.
How would you recommend knowing what to do? Because ultimately, the politicians, with their good-heartedness and their will to help the American people, or the leaders of any country who always have the people's best interest at heart, how can they know what that what that magic Laffer number is?
Well, they don't. They don't. But what you can know is how to get there. For example, you know the larger the tax base and the lower the rate, the more likely it is that an increase in rates will raise revenues. The narrower the tax base, the higher the rate, the less likely it is an increase will be to raise revenues. So you can start looking at taxes. And what you never want to have is a low base, high rate tax. Which is what we have on death taxes in the U.S., and we have it on corporate profits taxes. These are exactly the places you don't want to have high tax rates. Yeah, now, a Social Security tax, which is a very broad-based tax with few exceptions, those you can have higher rates and still collect more money. But it gives you a framework of how to design a tax code that actually works.
So can we assume that this is all theoretical? In other words, are you talking, you know, the United States has a progressive tax model that presumably the more you earn, the higher rate you're going to pay. But on the curve, you're not really showing that. Are you referring to an average tax, or is it ideally a flat income tax?
No, it should be at all rates. I mean, when you look at that on the highest rates, let's just do your progressive tax. The one tax, if you're looking for revenues, the one tax you should not raise is the highest rate, because that has the greatest disincentive effect, and these people have all the resources to evade, avoid, and otherwise not report taxable income. So it shouldn't surprise anyone that whenever the U.S. has raised the highest tax rate, revenues from the top 1% of income earners have declined as a share of GDP. Every time they've cut the highest tax rate, tax revenues from the top 1% of income earners as a share of GDP have gone up. So that's exactly what the principles of the curve show you. If you want to get revenues, you don't want to raise tax rates on the highest income earners, period.
We're talking with the father of supply-side economics, as Dr. Arthur Laffer is often referred to. He developed the Laffer curve, which actually became very popular, I guess, in the Reagan era. I want to focus a little bit more on this issue of not raising taxes on the highest tax brackets, the people who are earning the most. What about the question of fairness? Don't you think that these people should pay their fair share?
Well, maybe. But if you don't get it, it's not fair share, is it now? I mean, rich people have all sorts of availability open to them. They have wealth to be able to hire lawyers, accountants, deferred income specialists. They also have enough wealth to hire congressmen, senators, presidents, favor grabbers, and all these other people. They also have all sorts of ways of getting around taxes. They can change the location of their income. They can change the timing of their income. They can change the volume of their income. They can change the composition of their income. And they are the single group in the society that is the most adept at changing the tax bills they pay given a change in tax rates. So they are highly sensitive to tax rates. And you just aren't going to get their money. And if you aren't going to get their money, you may think it's fair, but you're not going to get their money, and you cause the economy to collapse in the aftermath.
Mm-hmm. Except in extenuating circumstances, like a war. Is that
sometimes
true?
For
and
a very short period
before,
of time.
Short term.
Yeah, short term, and with certain circumstances, extending circumstances, yes, you will. I mean, during the war, the rich people paid a lot of taxes, and they were very willing to do it because they had the money. But during normal times, Warren Buffett, I calculated, pays about 0.06% of his income in taxes, all legal. But he doesn't pay taxes on increases in unrealized capital gains. He doesn't pay taxes on the gift to his children's foundations. And I can go on and on and on. He uses every legal loophole there is and pays only about $7 million in taxes. And his income was about $12 billion in 2010. Now, that's the
type of income. Is that including capital gains?
Well, unrealized capital gains, he didn't pay any taxes on it.
That's not really income, then. That's a
difference. It sure is.
It's a growth.
I mean, income is your change in wealth plus what you spend plus what you give away. That's your income. Simon definition of income. I'll take increases in my wealth every day of the week in unrealized capital gains and feel a lot better about it.
But
that's income.
I'm not familiar with any governments that tax unrealized capital gains.
No, but the unrealized capital gains is exactly one of those loopholes.
Mm-hmm.
And what you should do, I mean, what you should do on a comprehensive tax is tax a person's spending on goods and services, on passing it on, all the gifts, and also on the increase in that person's wealth. That is your real income. That's the Simon definition of income, and it's the correct one to tax.
Right.
But otherwise, you'll do what he does, which he owns all of his stocks under the shield of Berkshire Hathaway. Berkshire Hathaway will buy and sell stocks, but he won't buy and sell Berkshire Hathaway. And so all of his wealth in Berkshire Hathaway has never been taxed. And believe me, it makes him a very powerful man.
Well, it's right.
And all the others do it, too. All the others do it, too.
When you say all the others, I don't feel
that Fortune 400, the top 400 wealthiest people.
Yeah, so listen, guys like you and me, right, we're doing okay. We have investment companies. We give a few speeches, write a few books. I personally don't feel that I'm able to use all those tools. And when they raise taxes, I just bend over and pay.
Oh, I'll bet you use a lot more of them than you really imagine. Do you own your own company?
I do.
Can you use some of the expenses that you can handle and pass through there? For example, can you employ your kids and do other stuff like that? All legal. But I do that. I mean, you know, when you do all the stuff there with a company, you can define benefit plans, you can describe things and make them so they fit you very well. And I'm not saying it's anything wrong with doing that. That's just what people do. But believe me when I tell you, you can really change your tax burden very substantially by manipulating the tax codes and the tax regulations. I mean, you really can do that. And, you know, I moved from California to Tennessee for one very simple reason. There's no income tax or death tax in Tennessee. None. Mm-hmm. I was able to buy my house in Belmead with my first year's tax savings. Now, that's just tax sheltering. I did the same income. I don't have to be in any one location or not. But that just is hugely. I can change the location of my income. I can change the composition of my income. I can change the timing of my income. I can choose when I pay myself and when I don't before the Obama tax increases went into effect. I had a huge bonus I paid myself from the firm with borrowing a lot of debt. And then the next year, I didn't pay myself any income. Perfectly legal. But I was able to shift the tax burden dramatically by changing the timing of my income. And so these other guys can really do it. Believe me, if I can do it, they can do it 10 times more.
Listen, we have to talk after the interview when the microphone's off. I think I'd like
to
get a little...
It's a deal. No, but you know exactly what I mean.
The way you're
you pay taxes
sure.
in New York. You pay taxes in New York?
I'm based in Israel, so no.
But. Oh, good for you. Well, if you were based in New York, I would suggest you move. Florida! Yeah. Why do all the people move to Florida?
What's it? Well, why don't all the people move to the no income tax states? Or are they doing
They do. They do. My book on the wealth of states, An Inquiry into the Nature and Causes of the Wealth of States with your friend, Rex Sinkfield. He and I did that book together. We show the migration patterns. You know, the nine states with no income tax in the U.S. have way outperformed the nine states with the highest income tax rates, both in population growth and migration and real gross state product and also in tax revenue.
So they have no income tax. How do they pay for teachers and nurses and police?
Well, they have property taxes. They have sales taxes. But they also don't have as many unemployed people because they're fast growing and have lots of jobs, so they don't need the welfare. And their schools are far better. Texas. I have a big chapter in my one book on comparing Texas with California. It's amazing how much better run Texas is than California. It has better education, has less welfare, you know, all of that stuff, and no taxes, effectively, no income taxes. They have a corporate tax, but they have no personal income taxes.
Well, don't they get all the money from oil? Isn't that the bottom line with Texas?
But no. They do get a little bit of money from oil, but not as much. And the reason California doesn't get its money from oil is they prohibit fracking. They prohibit drilling. It's amazing how little revenue you can get from something you prohibit.
Yeah, well, that'll stop it. I guess that's why they
that
legalize marijuana.
That does, right in this track.
All right. You know, it's fascinating. This has been a very, very macroeconomic discussion about, and hopefully all the politicians are listening and getting some good advice, because I'm certainly for lower taxes. But I just want to clarify one thing, and then I'll let you go. You're not necessarily saying that lowering taxes is all the time the right thing. You're saying that that there is a sweet spot in the Laffer curve where taxes can maximize government revenue, again, if that's your goal. But it doesn't. It's not that when people say, oh, the Laffer curve, he just wants to cut taxes on the rich. That's not what you're saying. Is that correct?
No, it's not the purpose of the Laffer curve at all. What you can say is we tax speeders to get them to stop speeding. We tax smokers to get them to stop smoking. Ask yourself, why then do we tax people who earn income? Why do we tax people who employ other people? Why do we tax companies that make great products at low cost and have a lot of profits? We don't do that to get them to earn less, to employ less, and to have less profits. We do it to collect the money. Mm-hmm. But don't for a moment think, Douglas, that those same effects aren't there that are there with smokers and with speeders. They are. What you need to do is collect your taxes in the least damaging fashion and spend the proceeds in the most beneficial fashion. That's what a good government actually does. And that's not what my government does. My rich people are the greatest people on earth. They pay for all sorts of public services. You don't want to make them the enemies. You want to take them out to dinner at night, send them birthday cards. You know, these are wonderful, wonderful people to have. And if you treat them nicely, they'll treat you nicely. But if you make them the enemies, believe me, they have the resources to really do you under.
All right. And we will watch to see what happens. Hopefully we're going to see in the new administration, we'll see a lot of great changes in the economy. Dr. Laffer, we will keep in touch about this. I want to thank you very much for your time. Tell me in the last few seconds, how can people follow you and follow your work?
Well, I'm really not very literate, if you can be honest with you, Douglas. I don't have a computer. I don't do emails. I'm an old person. I drool at night. I'm 76 years old. No, but you can always, anyone can get me at, I do have an email that I don't use very often, but drlaffer@laffer.com if anyone wants to contact me for books or anything else and see what I'm doing. I'd love to have them email me. But, you know, I don't do Twitter or any of that stuff.
All right.
Sorry.
So we will put a link to that. We'll also put a link to some of your books at the show notes of the show. I want to thank you very, very much for taking the time to talk today, and I hope we'll get to speak to you again soon.
Thanks, Douglas.
Okay, that was a fascinating interview with Dr. Arthur Laffer, the founder or creator of the Laffer Curve, known as the father of supply-side economics. And he certainly covered a lot, but before we actually go into the details, let me just see who's here today. Is that Joe Saul Sehy I hear in the background?
Is it? Where is he? Where is that guy?
What's happening, Joe?
Not much, man. I'm so happy to be here.
I thought you were always in the basement.
I am in the basement.
You never went anywhere but the basement.
And that is the charming voice of Linda P. Jones. Linda, what's happening?
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing very well.
How's Israel today?
Israel's awesome. It's always awesome here. I actually understand that Steve is going to, Spies, our engineer, is going to be sponsoring a Money Tree podcast panel trip to Israel, and we'll be recording next week here.
Live.
Thanks, right. Steve. We love that idea.
And that is Miranda Pipen. How you doing there, Miranda Marquette?
I'm doing okay. Making it happen over here in Idaho. Weather's great because, you know, the global warming that doesn't exist is providing 60-degree weather in November, which never happens in Idaho. So, hey, we may not even get snow this winter. Let's see.
Yeah, so we could look at averages. Let me ask you a question. So you're like, Idaho to me seems like there's a lot of average stuff going on there. What do you think would be the impact on average folks if their tax bracket was lowered?
Well, here in Idaho, we actually have pretty low taxes already. But yeah, for average folks, if the tax bracket was lowered, they would probably spend more and help the economy. And by average folks, I mean folks that are middle to lower income. Because if you look at studies from the 1930s on, the general indication is that that is where the best chance of stimulating the economy comes, is actually lowering taxes on the middle and lower income folks, because they're the ones that actually spend money.
Mm-hmm. Most of them don't actually pay tax at this point, right? Isn't something like 45 or 50% of Americans, I don't know about state tax in each state, but they don't pay federal income tax?
Yeah, that's one of the numbers they put out there. But that discounts the fact that most people are still paying FICA taxes. Most people are paying sales taxes. We got, you know, sales taxes. We got state income taxes. There are plenty of other taxes that middle to lower income people are actually paying. And that is why when you get away from the tax brackets and actually look at what's called the effective tax rate, things look a little bit different.
So, Linda, what if you had to pay less tax? What do you think would happen? What do you think the overall effect would be if people generally had to pay less tax?
Well, I'm a fan of paying less tax. I don't know about you, but I don't ever enjoy sending that check off to the IRS. So I think it's a good thing whenever we can reduce our taxes. And I think that when we can, that money can be redirected into other things. It can be spent, or it can be invested, or it can be reinvested into our business if we're a business owner. So I think it's good to free up some resources for some other things when possible.
And do you think if people actually had the money, they would go ahead and spend it, or it would just kind of sit on the sidelines?
I think a combination. I'm not sure everybody goes and spends it. I think some people would save. But again, we're not the greatest savers in the U.S. This isn't China, where they save a lot of money, most of their income. So I think a lot of people would probably end up spending it. Although I think, you know, some would probably save for college and retirement and that kind of thing, too. But generally, I remember when we used to get those rebate checks, and it seemed like people would go out and spend the rebate checks pretty quickly, and that did seem to boost the economy.
And that's the point. It's about who's getting the tax return. The top 5%, they're more likely to save it. They're not actually likely to to use the money in terms of actually being job creators. It actually doesn't create jobs when you give tax cuts to the top. There are several studies from the Tax Policy Center as well as the CBO that indicate that when you give tax breaks to the top 5%, they are more likely to invest it back in the stock market and see bigger income gains, as we've seen over the past couple of decades. When you give tax breaks to people in the middle and the bottom, those are the folks who go out and spend the money. It's the folks at the top that kind of hoard it a little bit or reinvest it in the stock market for themselves.
Joe, what do you think? Do you think when people invest in the stock market, is that a manner of helping the economy or is that just helping themselves?
Well, I think it's both. I think the bigger question, well, there's a couple, is this idea of the velocity of money. Miranda has it right. One of the gentlemen that they based the character Gordon Gekko on for the movie Wall Street actually talked about this, about how when people that have a lot of money get a dollar, they save it, which is interesting because that's who we're trying to pattern ourselves after, right? I mean, it's a great lesson. Somebody that has no money, they spend it. Somebody that has a lot of money, they save it. Now, a lot of that isn't just behavioral. Rich people aren't rich just because they're better savers and they have better habits. I understand, you know, it's a trickier subject for people. Poverty is a big, complicated topic. But I think that the idea of taxing people on the top less is interesting and I think misunderstood by people. You know, what's funny is that I really like this discussion, though, about collecting taxes versus changing the tax rate. I found that whole conversation fascinating because I totally agree. If you're a government, the tax that you actually get in your pocket, the amount of money you get is what's important, not the percentage that you're taxing people. And if you tax people enough that it makes it difficult for them to work, then obviously you're going to slow down the economy.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And I think that's been proven out. You know, if you go back all the way to the 1980s when we started and the tax rates were 70%, I think the government collected something like, you know, 70%, the total income they were taxing brought them in about $19 billion. Fast forward 8 years when the rate was down to 28%, and the government brought in five times that amount of money. And it was just simply because people, A, the rich people who do have facilities to try to defer taxes and delay taxes and do all sorts of things that are legal, I'm not even saying anything illegal, they're more willing to pay more tax and they earn more money. And ultimately, like you said, Joe, the number of dollars the government seems to collect somewhere on the Laffer curve can maximize. And it seems to me it's not by taxing everyone so much money and not by taxing the rich so much. And I think the proof is in the pudding.
Well, I'd like you mean the proof is in the pudding in terms of what's happened?
Yeah, we've seen from the 1980s when tax rates went down, the government earned a lot more. You see it in other countries as well, when Russia...
What we've seen, though, Doug, is the national debt go through the roof, which I think is my point, is the theory I love, but the execution of that theory has been absolutely horrible. It seems like politicians, you know, throw out the Laffer curve, and then they don't do anything to really balance a budget. If we did that in our normal, you know, everyday life,
don't learn from the government.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
right, but they're earning the money, but they're also, the problem was that they were spending way too much. And, you know, the revenues increased by lowering the tax rate, but the government.
Yeah. Yeah.
Theory, spending programs.
Yeah. The theory, fantastic. The execution of that in total, I think, has been ridiculous.
Well, I mean, some of that was just from the way that Social Security was set up, right? Because they set it up so that basically when you retired, you wouldn't live very much longer. But then our life expectancies increased so much that people are living longer and longer and longer. So it started out kind of with the idea it would be self-funding. And then now it's almost an impossibility to be self-funding. And then on top of that, we've had, you know, Medicare, Medicaid, and other things. And so with all these benefits, they never matched the income to the spending. And yeah. So,
and we've, well, yeah, you're right.
And part of that, though, is when you look at Social Security is a great example because it's actually a very regressive tax, because you actually stop paying your payroll taxes once you hit a certain amount of income. It's right around $118,000 a year right now. So that's a really good example, because once you get above a certain income, you are not paying on that income. You're not paying the Social Security tax on that income. And that's one of the reasons why it's become a little bit unsustainable, is because the people that are actually, and that's why I was talking about effective tax rates earlier, because when you go back there and you look at the regressiveness of the way the payroll tax works, because people who are middle to lower income are still paying that payroll tax. And it's not, and that's the thing, is Social Security is not an entitlement. It's something that you pay into. And when you get above a certain level of income, you're no longer paying FICO taxes on that. You're no longer paying your FICA, payroll taxes on that. So Social Security is actually a very regressive tax. FICA.
There's also a limit to how much you're going to get. In other words, it's not that if you earn $1 million and you put a lot more into Social Security, then you would get more than the $2,000 or $2,500 a month. That's why they max out, because there's only a limited amount of money that they'll give you once you hit, you know, 65 or whenever you start to claim.
But yeah, and I think it's interesting that we talk about that. But the tax cuts that we're talking about, the current election and Trump's victory, the analysis from Moody's, from Tax Policy Center, from just about everybody, is that Trump's tax cuts aimed at the top are going to cost us a ton if they go through. Everything from the Warren budget model, Tax Policy Center, to Moody's predict that. And, you know, we talk about, Joe brought up the national debt. Under Trump's plan to cut taxes mostly at the top, we're looking at we're looking at 105% GDP for our deficit and servicing that. And that means that under Trump's plan, if it's adopted, we will actually be paying more to service, you know, to do our debt than we have economic capacity for. Clinton's did not raise that as much. And, you know, it's interesting you talk about revenues going up or all of that stuff. But at the same time, you know, where is that going, and what kind of priorities do we have, and do we need to rejigger our priorities? You know, what kind of things do we value as a society? Because that's what we're going to have to start deciding here pretty soon. Do we value taking care of the least among us, among our society? If not, then I guess we'll just let them die and suffer. If we, you know,
I'm not sure that was the model there.
We're going to have to make some hard choices here. And as we've seen since the 1930s, cutting taxes at the top is one of the least effective ways. And a list of 11 things that you can do to help stimulate the economy.
What, raising taxes is one of them?
No, cutting taxes is number 11. Tax cuts are the least effective way to do that. The Congressional Budget Office did an analysis a few years ago, and they looked at 11 proposals for spurring economic growth, and cutting taxes was the least effective out of the 11 proposals.
Well, let's talk a little bit about cutting taxes, what people can do on their own. Linda, when you think about ways of saving taxes, one of the things that Dr. Laffer pointed out was that the wealthy have all these tools, but what do you recommend to people who maybe don't have all the tools if they're looking for ways of actually limiting the amount of tax that they're going to pay?
Well, it gets harder and harder to do that. I mean, obviously, a 401k is the biggest one that most people can participate in and not be taxed on that income that they contribute. But it's difficult. I mean, I think you have to do what he said, time your revenue and expenses as much as you can. And if you're self-employed, that's easier for some people. You can also look at your capital purchases. You know, when are you making purchases in technology and some higher priced items that might be more helpful to business owners as well? But I think business owners have much more available to them than certainly people that are, you know, that are employed at a company have. It's difficult. I mean, we can look at muni bonds or something like that too, but again, that only makes sense for certain people in certain income brackets, and the rates are so low right now, that's even debatable whether that's a good idea, and I'm not a big fan of bonds right now, so that kind of puts some limits on that, but it's tough. I don't think there's a whole lot that are available right now.
Joe, what do you got for us?
Well, I think everybody has a few. I mean, you know, just looking at the way that you save for retirement, I think that the IRA, the Roth IRA, using those effectively, anybody that itemizes their taxes, it's funny, when I was a financial planner, I'd go over the itemized deductions page with people, because when you actually read that page, the government tells you about things that a lot of people don't know about and don't take advantage of. People have extra stuff laying around their house. Taking the charitable deduction, if you itemize, is big. Now, if you have the standard deduction, I think you're pretty much limited to what you can do, you know, to shelter money at work, or just get paid under the table. No.
We can cut that out if you want. I think, you know, other things that people can do is just to consider, you know, if you have a lot of gains and you're going to sell out of positions, just doing tax loss harvesting, which means looking at maybe you've had some losers. I think psychologically, a lot of people don't like to sell their losers because it's kind of like admitting a mistake. But if you can get up, you know, and say, hey, I made a mistake, or, you know, I lost, let me sell. And that gives you a tax loss, which, assuming it's not in an IRA, but in your regular brokerage account, use that to offset your gains. And that actually can lower your tax bill, you know, and if you have a lot of losses, heck, that could be considered really good. Especially now, this time of year, that's something that, you know, we spend a lot of time helping clients with the tax loss harvesting. Just look around and see what you can get rid of that's at a loss, just to help you next April. So let's look a little bit further. Let's say that you know, other ways that people look to save on taxes, in fact, that Dr. Laffer pointed out, is he left California, which had these huge taxes, said, I'm moving to a place with a lower income tax model. Is that something, Miranda, that you would consider? Well, you said you're already in a lower tax state.
Well, yeah, actually, my state tax went up when I moved from Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania actually has a lower tax rate than Idaho, which kind of surprised me a little bit. But the cost of living is low enough here in Idaho Falls than it was in Philadelphia that it makes up for it. But yeah, no, that's an interesting thought, because people do talk about the flight of the wealthy from states with taxes. And I do know entrepreneurs, about three of them that we know personally, right, Joe, who have moved to Tennessee in recent years to take advantage of the lower tax situation in Tennessee. And so there is that. But when you look at the numbers, interestingly enough, you have to balance that against, you know, the lifestyle you want and the kinds of things you want access to. Because they talk about this flight, and Laffer may have left California, but there are still plenty of wealthy people hanging out in California willing to pay that price because of the lifestyle preferences that they have. And, you know, I'm here in Idaho paying a higher state income tax because my mom lives down the street, and I've got I'm a single mom now. So here I am making a lifestyle decision that's worth it to me. I mean, part of it's the cost of living here in Idaho is low enough, and my income is high enough in terms of an Idaho average income that it makes up the difference for the higher state taxes I'm paying. So a lot of that goes into the calculation. And I would be willing to move back to Philadelphia, even though I'm going to pay more out of my pocket, just because of my lifestyle preferences and the things that I like to do. And so I think before you leave, just for the sake of lower taxes, think about, well, what kind of lifestyle am I giving up?
And I also want to add that we know some people that have moved to Puerto Rico for lower taxes. And that's become a trend, and people have to incorporate their business there. But it's a trend for large hedge funds to be moving out of New York to Puerto Rico, and for people that are high income earners to move to Puerto Rico to get in a much, much lower tax bracket. I think even Peter Schiff, I believe, has incorporated in Puerto Rico and done that for tax purposes. So there's a lot of movement around the globe for tax reasons.
Puerto Rico just had me a better coffee. That was good enough for me.
A better coffee?
That could be.
Oh, Puerto Rican coffee is phenomenal.
Oh, I've never had it. Did you have it here in the States or actually there?
I had it there, and then I brought a bunch home, and just phenomenal coffee.
Just straight coffee. You didn't mix anything in it as you came over the border.
I did not. Depends on the day, but no, not as a practice.
What do you think? One of the things that Laffer said, which I thought was clever, is the way the government is able to control people's activities is through charging them. You know, he said if you want to stop people from smoking, so you raise the tax on cigarettes, and if you want to stop people from drinking, you raise the tax on booze, or stop them from speeding, you know, you charge them for that. It feels like the same way. If you want to stop people from earning money, you just charge them more tax. Does that make sense to you?
Not really, because to a certain degree, yes, you hit that point where you're taxing people enough that they can't spend money. But we actually haven't reached that point. According to a recently published economic analysis and paper from just a sec, let me.
Also the CBO?
No, it's not the CBO. It's actually a study. Oh, here we go. A study from Owen Zadar at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business, who did a study about getting the biggest bang for your buck, focusing your tax relief on the poor and the middle class. But he says the positive relationship between tax cuts and employment growth is largely driven by tax cuts for lower income groups and the fact that the effect of tax cuts for the top 10% unemployment growth is small. But he goes on to say in this that there is a point where you get to the point where you tax even the top 10% to a point where, yeah, they can't, it's not effective anymore. But he says we're not to that point yet. We still have a little bit of room to go there before we reach that point. So yes, to a certain degree, too many taxes are going to eventually be problematic, but we're probably not there yet. At least according to my personal opinion and several economists, actually, economists, and not just this guy from the Booth School of Business, but there are several other economists who have said we're not to that point yet, including Joseph Stiglitz, who just won a Nobel Prize.
Nice, nice. Well, we can go to Berkeley, the one of the most, let's say, progressive universities, and where the husband and wife team of Romer and Romer also did a similar study, feeling that about 28 to 30% was a reasonable maximum tax. I think it leads to two questions. One is the goal of all this to maximize the revenues for the government, which goes back to, if you give them a lot of money, then, you know, is that where the money should be going? And secondly, is it the right thing to do?
And just to say, I think it's interesting that they say, well, you know, just 28% is like whatever. But most of the wealthy in that top tax bracket that are in like the 39.5% tax bracket, they may be in that tax bracket. But once again, if you go back to the effective tax rate, most of them are actually they're paying less in terms of effective tax rate than I am. And we've been over this before, right? Romney, back in the 2012 election, his effective tax rate was like a little bit more than 15%.
Well, that's what Laffer was telling us about his...
Yeah, so I mean, so that's the other thing. I mean, it's deceptive to talk about, oh, these high tax brackets. Well, let's take a step back and let's talk about effective tax rate. Because, you know, I agree. If you're going to say, okay, well, the top effective tax rate for somebody should be about 28%, that's great. We are not there yet, which means that these economists who are saying, yeah, we can afford to tax the top 10% a little bit more, apparently they're right.
Well, maybe we should just simplify it, because it's exactly true what you're saying. I agree with you. It's so complicated that everyone, you know, everyone who has the money is going to find a way around it. And, you know, you look at countries where they initiated a flat tax and it was fair because everyone pays the same percentage.
Oh.
Their growth skyrocketed.
Oh.
Look, for example, I know you'd love this. we should let someone else have a turn, but we will just note.
Joe and Linda are just like, why is this happening to us?
Yeah, all right. I'm sorry.
No, I'm happy that you're so studied in that area that you can make a contribution and quote, you know, papers and all of that. I think it's great.
I just think it's interesting you mentioned the flat tax. And I'm in favor of a more progressive type flat tax. But the problem you run into with a straight flat tax, which is actually something that we have almost in Idaho, we have basically, I want to say, two or three tax brackets, but it's a pretty low income threshold to get to that point. The problem you run into with a straight flat tax is, let's say we have a straight flat tax of like 10%, right? And I'm just doing this because that's easy numbers. So if you're talking about me and I make a nice income, when I pay my 10% flat tax, it is not going into things like my food and my transportation to get to work every day and the things that I need to live. But if you look at the Idaho's median income and you tax them a 10% flat tax, well, now the taxes that they're paying in that flat tax, that is getting into their food and that is getting into the transportation they need to get to work and the clothes that they need to buy for their children. And everybody likes to say a flat tax is fair, but it does disproportionately impact the amount of discretionary income that somebody with a lower income has. And once again, tax policy at that lower to middle income level and providing relief for those at the lower income level so that they have more discretionary income is what is most effective in economic terms.
So then would you raise like the minimum that
so I would, yeah, I would either raise that threshold and say, okay, if you're under a certain amount of income, you don't pay that tax, or you have a progressive flat tax where you say, okay, at this income level, you pay this percentage, at this income level.
But how can you have a progressive tax bracket? It's either flat or it's progressive.
Well, that's the thing. It's sort of like a hybrid. You know, it's basically saying, okay, so you want to do a flat tax, but get rid of all these deductions that bring down the upper levels, the deductions and loopholes that they can choose to lower their effective tax rate to 15%.
Right. I have no problem with helping people who are very poor and can't afford to pay anything, but just realize that now with something like half the country not having to pay tax, when they have to vote for someone who's going to say, raise the tax on the rich and we'll take the money from them and give it to the people who don't have enough, all of a sudden you're in the situation where, of course, all you have half the country, they're going to vote to take the money from other people because what do they care? It's not
actually,
their concern
anymore. Actually, they just didn't.
That's what's amazing.
So,
let's see what happens.
So it's a nice theory to say, oh, well, blah, 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 but they just didn't. So this
actually,
this election,
the majority of them did, but the electoral majority didn't.
But that's true. That's true. The popular vote is still. But here's the thing, though. So I mean, and the thing you have to realize is when you know that actually funds programs more than it does funding actual money to go into people's pockets. That funds programs, and it's a nice thought to say, oh well, if you cut taxes on the rich, then they'd give to charity. But the study that they did a couple years ago indicates that if you did that, the need in this country would still be huge because the rich actually don't donate as much of their income as the poor do.
100%.
So it's a nice thought to say, oh, well, you know, let's go ahead and do that and take this, that, and the other thing. But a lot of what our tax, and once again, it goes back to what I'm saying, you know, are we the kind of society as what we like to say? We like to say, oh, well, we're the richest country we've ever seen here in America. Well, that's great. But what kind of people are we morally? Are we morally the kind of people that take care of our neighbors, or have we just decided to say, screw you? Well, I don't know. I mean,
well, I'm a big fan.
Let's see what our decisions are right now. So
let's see what our neighbors here are thinking. Joe, are you a type of guy who takes care of his neighbor?
Who says, screw my neighbor?
Yeah. No, seriously. Yeah, go ahead.
You know, actually, I need to go back about 15 minutes ago. To a point, which was about moving and about where you live, because I think that's probably the only place that I'll be able to add insight, I think, into this discussion, which is that, you know, Linda mentioned Peter Schiff and moving to Puerto Rico. And I think that even Dr. Lafler moving out of California, I think there has to be a balance between opportunities because you're in a place and what the tax is going to be. So there's money coming in the door, and then there's money going out. And as an example, I live in Texarkana, Texas now, in this not very big city. Early in my career, I really needed the connections that I had in a much bigger city to propel my career. And had I been in New York, because as an example, you look at some of our friends that are in New York City, they go on the national talk shows all the time. They do a lot of financial media stuff because they're right in the middle of it. It's very easy for them to plug into a lot of the other players that are there. And in California, there are some things. So I think if people are listening to this and they're thinking they'll move to a state where the tax rate's lower and they're just starting their career, I think I might be looking more opportunities. A guy like Peter Schiff, it makes sense for, because he's already wealthy. He already has the contacts. When I moved to Texarkana, I already had a fair number of contacts. So it was easier for me to move because I'd already developed that than it would have been had I done that at, you know, 25.
How about you, Linda? Are you the type who's going to move for a better tax bracket?
Well, I went from Washington State, where there's no state income tax, to California, so I didn't do that very well, not did I? Most people are going the other direction.
We want to learn from you.
We call Linda the salmon.
Going upstream. All right, Lindy, nothing we've really covered a lot, but maybe we should begin to wrap it up now. Do you want to give your final thought and then tell people what's going on in the world of Linda P. Jones, Be Wealthy and Smart?
Well, over at Be Wealthy and Smart, we have a podcast about should you buy or rent high-end homes? And it's an interesting discussion and something I think that people would be interested in hearing.
Ooh, I would like to do that. Not only hear about it, but we once went out west in Oregon, rented this awesome home. It was fantastic, of course, then coming back to our own home wasn't the same, but I'll look forward to that. And hey, Joe, what's going on down in the basement?
Well, we're incredibly excited and honored because Kiplinger just came out with their December issue, the actual print version, and their best of 2016, and listed the Stacking Benjamins podcast as best podcast.
Congratulations. That's awesome.
It was amazing, and we didn't even pay him $20. Mom is super excited because she thinks that's going to get us out of the basement, but we're going to break it to her that just... you know, makes us realize that the effective tax rate down here in the basement is zero. So we're going to keep it here as long as possible.
It is well deserved. Well deserved. You really put a lot into the show.
Thank you.
And hey, Miranda, what's going on with you?
Yeah, why don't you go ahead and head on over to Student Loan Hero, which is a site that I'm a senior writer at, and I have like sort of a real job there now. I mean, it's a real job. It's like a W-2 job now, but I still get to do it from home and wearing my pajamas. So I guess, anyway, head on over to Student Loan Hero. I've got a post up about, you know, five ways that you can protect your finances no matter who's in charge. So it's all about protecting yourself. And then I also have a little thing about how not to let market events dictate your decision making when it comes to your portfolio. So head on over to Student Loan Hero, check out their new investing content because it's mostly written by yours truly.
So I bet it's awesome. And at the Goldstein on Geld show, actually, we're pretty excited because our YouTube channel just topped 250,000 downloads, which is very exciting. So if you like getting some financial ideas in sort of a video format with a lot of these actually very fun 4-minute videos there, just go to YouTube and you can look up Douglas Goldstein or Goldstein on Geld and, hey, sign in for the channel. Then we can stay in touch. And I think that's about it today. I think thanks to, especially Miranda, I have to thank you. We've pretty much solved the taxation problem. I'll send this over to the president-elect Donald Trump and let him know how we think it should be handled. And maybe you could just take us out.
Hey, remember to visit us at moneytreepodcast.com. Listen to all of our episodes. Subscribe to us on iTunes and Stitcher and send us some listener mail. Let us know how you feel about us. And hey, I'd love to hear from you about how much you hate my tax ideas. So go ahead. Send us an email. We love it.
Wait, hold on. I got to write a letter to you now.
That's right. Anyway,
I'll be first.
Remember, no one cares about your money as much as you do. So invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.